This is Speaking Freely. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for listening. Jamie McLeod Skinner is what you probably call a multi-hyphenate. She's a lawyer, an engineer, and a longtime politician in Oregon. You may remember 2 years ago, she defeated seven-term incumbent Democratic Congressman Kurt Schrader in the primary for Oregon's 5th Congressional District, but later lost the general election to Republican former Happy Valley Mayor Lori Chavez de Remer. In this year's election, McLeod Skinner is vying for a rematch. She and State Representative Janelle Bynum will face off in May's primary for the right to represent the Democrats in November's general election against Republican Congresswoman Chavez de Remer. So in this episode, let's take a closer look at McLeod Skinner. Here, she describes her rural roots and upbringing and how they inform her choices and leadership goals.
I come from proud working family roots. My grandparents were union factory workers. My grandfather built trains and built tractors. My single mom would get up early to drive a school bus, to teach all day. I'd drive a school bus home in the summers. She was a farm worker, and that's how she fed my brother and I. And my aunt was actually a nurse. As a child, I actually lived in the Midwest, in East Africa, and in Southern Oregon. So I'm a proud product of Oregon public schools. And some of my own experiences with access, or actually without access to healthcare, was when I was a child in East Africa, I almost died from a very severe bout of malaria. And the hygiene was so poor at the main hospital that my mom was actually afraid to take me to the hospital. Thus my shout out to janitors who helped to keep those facilities clean. When I was in high school in Oregon, again, my family at that point was, we didn't have a lot of means. And my graduation gift from high school was a week at the Steens Mountain running camp. I was a runner back then. I was an athlete. I came back in the best shape of my life. And I was working out with my soccer teammates before going off to college. And I ended up injuring my knee. And because I knew my mom couldn't afford to address the issue, I just cuffed it out, and it didn't find out for a year that I actually torn my ACL. I spent that year actually up at Lewis and Clark, my first year of college, which is actually in the 5th Congressional District. But I went on to get degrees in civil engineering from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, from Cornell University with a master's in regional planning. My thesis actually focused on protecting a local ag economy while also protecting water, because the city that the water flowed to did not filter its water. So public health issues have been something I've worked on for a large part of my career. And then after working in different fields for several years, came back to Oregon, got my law degree focused on water law and Indian law. And that's my professional background. Leadership work I've done is I've got a leadership certificate from Harvard University for state and local elected officials, Oxford, a certificate in human rights with a focus on protecting human rights. Ethics is really important to me. And I also went through the Santa Clara University Markkula Center for Ethics for Applied Ethics for Elected Officials. All of these things are key, I think, to good public policy, understanding issues and actually helping to address and solve issues. I began my public service over in Bosnia, Kosovo, just after the war. I did not serve in uniform. I'd come out as a young adult, and back then you could not serve in the military if you were out. So I worked for a humanitarian organization, and I managed the reconstruction of schools and hospitals in war-torn areas, and so worked very closely with medical professionals who were struggling to provide basic services in shelled-out buildings with limited supplies and without basic water and sanitation. Returned to the U.S., led Refugee Resettlement, which also worked on unique healthcare issues that some of the folks we served were dealing with coming to the States and integrating into the U.S. system. I worked in local government at the local and regional levels on water resources and housing as a staff city manager and also as an elected policymaker, and led wildfire recovery in Southern Oregon after the terrible wildfires that we have, and the public health issues that came out from that environmental catastrophe. Also work in natural resource management, affordable housing, education policy, community resilience building. I currently serve on the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, focused on environmental health and watershed health, and then also have served on the Jefferson County Education Service District Board. Having lived and worked in countries who are both at war and in post-war, understanding the importance and fragility of our democracy is, I think, part of the discussion as well. We need a functional government. And part of that is having leaders who can work together to solve problems. I believe our politics needs to be solution oriented. And my success in purple areas, and my wife and I live in rural Central Oregon, is really based on this approach of bringing people together across our divides to focus on the challenges that we're facing and solving problems. And part of that is not using buzzwords. And I've noticed that, especially in healthcare discussions, I've had some really interesting conversations with folks across the state, including people in very rural areas, folks who identify as very conservative, who, when we use buzzwords talking about making sure everyone has health care, will respond negatively to some of those buzzwords, some of the terms, some of the names we use. But at the same time, when we engaged in conversation and I asked him, what kind of health care do you want for your family and your community? He essentially described what many would refer to as Medicare for all. And so I find that when we talk about ideas, that's how we connect and that's how we understand and address the joint challenges that we're facing. I've had the good fortune of learning from and working with folks across our state. And the stories I've heard would both break your heart and also motivate you to really come together to make sure we move forward on addressing what is now not a fully functional system for not just all Oregonians, but really for folks across our country. I had the good fortune of learning from a student working in Oregon City, a high school student who's working with his peers on mental health policy and behavioral health issues. And his perspective is really informative in my sense of the policy we need to move forward on the volunteer work I've done with farm workers, seeing the impact of pesticide use. Remember a woman in rural Central Oregon who talked about how critical healthcare was to her family. They had to put their family farm on the market because her mom needed care. And that farm had been their family for three generations, but they couldn't deny their mom. And so they were facing bankruptcy because of inadequate access to healthcare. There's some great work going on around our state. Clackamas County has a free clinic that's doing amazing work for folks who don't have access to many other systems in place, the healthcare systems, folks who are documented and undocumented, houseless people. And so getting the resources and providing the support necessary, if people don't have some of this basic care provided, our communities bear costs in other ways. There's also just an awareness of friends who only have access to Indian Health Services have pointed out to me that even prior to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, they didn't have access to abortion health care. So understanding the realities of folks throughout our state, throughout our country, I think is a really key part of these conversations. The mom I met in Clackamas County who lost her son to a fentanyl overdose, understanding these crises, and kudos to the governor and others who announced and declared a fentanyl emergency in Oregon, and the leaning into addressing this challenge is critical right now. A woman I met in Albany who's struggling with Parkinson's, and because of the increased cost of the medication, she is getting out less because she can't afford the medication she needs to be able to enable her to go into spend more time in her community. And that also speaks to the importance of policymakers being accountable to people. I appreciate pharmaceutical companies and all the work they do in creating pharmaceuticals, but we also need policymakers who are accountable to people and are able to negotiate and pressure pharmaceuticals not to be driving up prices. So things like having Medicare negotiate prescription drug costs, going beyond insulin, which is a great first step, but making sure that drugs are affordable is really important. I proudly don't take corporate PAC money because I believe in being accountable to Oregonians and to people who need advocates in government. Government's role is to provide safe and healthy communities where people and families can thrive. And that means responsible stewardship of our limited public resources so that we can invest in this work and be accountable to people. I was first elected to office 20 years ago to a city council. And I've always said I don't believe in spending public money. I believe in investing it. Whether we're talking about education or healthcare or natural resource protection or our local economies, making sure that we're investing in the people who are able to thrive in our communities. I also believe that government needs to know when to help out, when to get out of the way. And when it comes to ensuring that we all have access to healthcare and affordable healthcare and accessible healthcare, especially for rural folks, government has the role of helping out. When it comes to making decisions about things like abortion healthcare and reproductive choice, government needs to get out of the way. Healthcare specifically is just part of our overall public health. And public health is impacted when our basic needs aren't being met. We're seeing this right now in Oregon, the crisis with inadequate housing, inadequate affordable housing, food security, which means both a sufficient supply of food, but also healthy food. And I'm really proud of work that local farmers are doing throughout our state, but especially here in Central Oregon, to have farm-to-table programs to address the spike in food insecurity that we've seen, especially with reduction in SNAP programs, and the need to move the farm bill forward and get that passed. Access to transportation and inadequate childcare also impacts overall public health. Family and community relationships, especially since COVID, we're seeing from young people, from seniors across the board, behavioral health and support. We don't have a fully integrated system and a support system necessary. We don't have some of the staffing necessary to do that work. Public health is impacted also when our personal safety is at risk and those ongoing stresses. One of the incredibly informative documentary I've read, and I strongly encourage it to healthcare providers if you haven't, it's called Unnatural Causes, and it's not a sponsorship. It's a documentary I want to mention because it talks about how racial and socioeconomic inequities impact public health, creating greater vulnerabilities and those stresses, those daily stresses on us, making us more vulnerable to health impacts. With the climate crisis, the impacts we're seeing on environmental health from the ice storms we just saw and heat waves. Think of our farm workers working in fields and having to deal with the heat domes that we're seeing. We've lost people. People have literally died in the field because of those stresses to our bodies. Air and water quality. I have a great love for talking about water issues. Any discussion about healthcare and public health really starts with people, those providing the services. So we need to make sure that we have people who are fully trained and who are supported in doing their work and get in. It's crazy that we have healthcare providers who don't themselves have adequate healthcare, but are also dealing with staffing loads and dealing with pressures that do not enable them to do the work they love of taking care of people. We need to do a better job at that. And I really appreciate all those experts that I've learned from, policy experts to the medical professionals, the youth leaders that are supporting their peers, patients, family members of patients. And the things, their individual perspectives, they're all frontline experts. And learning from the experts as a policymaker is critically important, understanding that perspective. I've talked to too many nurses who are just struggling so much from burnout and not having the adequate resource and support they need to care for their families. Care for the caregiver is a real key concept that we need to make sure we lean into to make sure we're providing a good system and helping the people who are providing great healthcare and public health in our communities. And frankly, politics is often getting in the way of that shared goal that we really have. My core philosophy is everyone has access to physical and behavioral, mental health, behavioral health, dental, vision. And when I say access, I talk about affordability, but I also mean that physical proximity. The word access is really important to those living in rural areas because so many times if something happens to you and you're in a rural remote area, getting access, getting proximity access to healthcare is critical. I believe there's really no excuse for being the only industrialized nation not providing healthcare to all those who live in our country. It's shameful. And yes, there are challenges to doing that. But I had a professor once told me all the easy problems are solved. That's why we need leaders who will really lean into solving and working on these problems. In terms of the existing models that we have, there's other countries we can be learning from, whether it's Germany and Canada having those dual systems that I think allow us to bridge a lot of the divides in these discussions. But also, they're looking at 10% of their GDP. We're looking at almost twice that in terms of what we're spending. And so those models are out there. Allowing employers to negotiate more extended coverage, so having those dual systems, I know is really important to some folks. And then also the language we use. I was talking to someone about social determinants of health, and I know that's been a part of the conversation for a long time, but she was pointing out that now talk more about health opportunities for everyone and resiliency, because now social determinants for health has sometimes become a buzzword that gets in the way of moving the conversation forward. So we need to focus on ideas, and we need to find the way to move these ideas forward throughout the political maze that we find ourselves in. Because the bottom line is, if we invest in healthcare, and especially things like preventative healthcare, it's pennies on the dollar. We not only save people pain and discomfort, we save money, and we prevent other problems and other costs that we bear without doing that work. And the classic example is if an emergency room is your first and last resort, as it is for many folks who are houseless, it drives down the costs of quality of life, and it drives up the cost of healthcare. COVID has proven how vulnerable our system is, and so we need to improve our overall health. And so those goals of better access and better outcomes and lower costs, we know there's models out there so we can do it. We just need to build up that political will to actually get it done. I also believe we need to not just improve the system, but better integrate our systems. Just one example is public safety and mental health care. And there's programs like in Eugene, they've got the CAHOOTS program, where you have public safety officers who are often the first call when there's a behavioral health challenge, and having behavioral health specialists there allow them to address the situation more effectively and more appropriately. Models like value-based care, so where providers are paid based on outcomes rather than just the traditional fee-for-service, I think these are really important conversations to have to challenge us to do better in our systems. And then, of course, improving access, things like telehealth. So rural broadband has been a big issue for a long time as part of our infrastructure. It's also key to providing healthcare in many key areas. So those opportunities for improvement, I think, are real great opportunities to continue this conversation. But one thing I just want to come back to, and I touched on it briefly, is access to abortion healthcare. It is essential to protecting our fundamental rights. And this is personal for me. I actually, my wife, and she's given me permission to tell this story. Many years ago, she had a miscarriage and was bleeding out. And had she not had access to an abortion, she would have died. And the fact that we've got politicians preventing access to abortion health care is not only unconscionable. Frankly, it's also practicing medicine without a license. They're taking away the ability of doctors to protect the health of their patients and taking away the decision from women about their own health care, about access to abortion health care. And frankly, it's practicing medicine without a license, and that's committing a crime. And I frankly believe should be prosecuted for medical malpractice. I also believe we should just provide that as a fundamental right. But I also think it's more than just a political discussion. It is an attack on people's health care.
Jamie McLeod Skinner was speaking at a candidates forum put on by the City Club of Portland and the Oregon Physicians for a National Health Program. At this forum, she was asked, if elected, how will you quickly become an expert on your elected committee's policies and objectives, and how will you build support among relevant stakeholders, both familiar and unfamiliar?
Yeah, the first is to listen to the experts. And as I mentioned before, when I think of experts, I think of everyone from policy experts to the frontline staff providing the services to the healthcare professionals, to also those who have experience with the system. Everyone who has interfaced with the system, it has an expertise that is an important part of the discussion. So the big picture policy, having a sense of what are some of those major changes we can make, also sometimes there's those smaller changes we can make, is a really key part of understanding the big picture, having a long-term vision, but also ultimately moving forward. And sometimes you can take big steps and sometimes you take smaller steps in the long path forward. The other piece about building relationships, I mentioned I was first elected to a city council, to public office 20 years ago. And I had the actual good fortune of being in the political minority, because what you learn when you're in that situation, it really forces you to learn how to engage with your colleagues and learn how to learn politics and learn statesmanship. And when you build up those relationships and you are also able to talk about ideas and understand your colleagues and what their goals are and show an alignment and try to build that alignment with goals, is how you are effective in moving things forward. I think the biggest disadvantage to folks who step into a role, whether they're in the majority or the minority politically, is not having that experience of being in the political minority. If you haven't been there, you don't understand how to effectively move things forward. And especially in a place as complicated as Congress, with complicated in terms of all the different issues that are coming at you, you have to have those skills and you have to have that savvy and that understanding. And also being a rural Democrat, relationships are key. And so that's, having that approach is something that's allowed me to be very successful. Even when I was elected to an education service district board in Central Oregon, again, a political minority, was able to move forward some really key issues, including issues around equal access and social justice and equity, with some very conservative colleagues, respected colleagues, because we talked about how we were taking care of our kids and how we were focused on the needs of our kids. And by using language that is accessible and leading with ideas. And then also doing the hard work behind the scenes. I'm proud of my hard work ethic, and that's how you learn, and then also how you actually practice the art of politics is how you get things done.
McLeod Skinner was asked, what are the economic and social benefits of a national health care program?
Multiple. Essentially, making sure everyone has access to health care by using that public health lens and making sure people get the care they need, the preventative care, and get the care they need early on. It allows people to have a higher quality of life. It decreases costs. It also prevents or limits impacts in other areas. I gave the example on behavioral health and the partnership with public safety. Public safety costs and also tragic results that can result from public safety officers who may not have the behavioral health training engaging with someone who's having a behavioral health crisis. We see problems, we incur costs, and there are sometimes very tragic consequences to not having some of those systems that are integrated. The importance of doing this is that you can argue it from many different angles. You can talk about from an economic standpoint that if we have folks who are more healthy, they're more engaged, our workforce is stronger or more effective and more productive. So whether it's those quality of life issues, whether it's limiting the costs that families are bearing and enabling families to be more effective and families to thrive, there are so many from that big picture perspective, but also from the individual family perspective, there's so many net benefits. And yeah, it's when you look at it from that perspective, I think while there will be some costs and will be some challenges to making some additional transitions, there's an overall benefit that the country economically, socially will benefit from.
What's the best way to lower costs? Here's how McLeod Skinner answered that one.
And this does start with a conversation with experts who can come in and talk details. But generally speaking, this is something from the Oregon Joint Task Force on Universal Healthcare. It talked about the cost and complexity and the equitable access being some of the biggest challenges we have here in Oregon, but really across the country. And so being able to work on those steps that can reduce costs, and some of those details will be addressing inefficiencies, which is a good first step. Inefficiencies, from what I've seen, we're talking about 25%. If we improve that, we can bring down costs and thus expand access and care. We have those efficiencies in provider billing, in the high rate of private health care insurance overhead. And if we look back to, again, Oregon's done a great job. It is ahead of the curve on this. But there are, if you look at former Governor Kitzhaber's, his vision that he brought as a healthcare provider and the push for the coordinated care organizations, that model of integrating services is a really powerful one. And there's some really great concepts that are out there. Again, Oregon has been a leader on this, of the integration of public health and resilience center approach. So almost a one-stop shop. And back when I was a city planner, we used to do this for folks in working on development, but we can do the same for healthcare, where we're looking at integration of bringing somebody, identifying the needs and the challenges that they're having, from housing to legal services to the psychosocial needs that families are addressing. I've had some great conversations with educators, and they're talking about schools being essentially resilience centers and resilience hubs. Some of the work I'm doing right now in helping out the state and building up resilience, and this is an investment that our state's been making, is leaning into resilience centers in our communities. And some of those are targeted more on responses when there's an environmental crisis, but human resiliency also addresses healthcare, that physical healthcare, but also that behavioral and that mental healthcare as well. And developing those systems and using those three pillars that former Governor Kitzhaber had laid out, I think is a really good model and approach.
How would she provide for expanding mental healthcare access in Oregon and across the country?
One of the big challenges we have is not having enough providers. And then also our systems are not as well integrated. And again, this is what I've heard from those who are providing mental health care in the field, making sure that mental health care, behavioral health care is seen as a fundamental part of our healthcare system, that it is not an added part. It is fundamental and integral to that system is first and foremost, but also addressing things like the taboos of obtaining care. Education about resources that are available, first making them available, but then also making sure that people know about them. I mentioned the student leader, a high school student who's also on the Youth Advisory Committee in Oregon City. And I asked him this specifically because he's doing a lot of work with his peers. And I asked him, what the biggest needs were. What I also asked what most people don't understand about what his peers are experiencing. And then also, I love always asking the magic wand question. If you had a magic wand, what would you change? So again, turning to an expert on this, because it's my job as a policymaker to listen to experts and to move things forward in the areas that are needed. He talked about just that there's not enough mental health support. And also, even when there was available, they didn't know where to find it. And that's been a real frustration that his peers have had in terms of not, you know, when I asked, what do most people not understand about what you and your peers are facing? He said, especially older folks, he said there's that rhetoric of toughen up, or even he referred to toxic masculinity in the sense that people shouldn't feel like they can access it. And that the importance of creating safe space for people to access it. And again, this is his term and his expression when talking to his peers, saying it was not manlike or guys couldn't express their feelings. And maybe it is easier for women or there's less social stigma to access, but that's important to understand and asking those questions and learning about that and then trying to find out how to better access. I know in talking to veterans, especially on behavioral health and mental health, the feedback I've received is we need people who are professionals who understand our experience. And even back when I was working with refugees, I would bring in a mental health care provider. It was seen as novelty then, but when you come out of a war environment, it's a very intense experience. And part of survivability and adaptability and resilience is being able to address that experience. And I remember the mental health care professional I worked with, her favorite question when she would talk to folks, especially who would come from, she would typically see that it would be men who would say, I'm not crazy. I don't need mental health care. And she would always say, you've just come out of a crazy situation. War is crazy. Only crazy people are not affected by a crazy situation. And that was the way she was able to get access to folks who were otherwise felt too proud or felt that there was shame associated with getting access to behavioral health and mental health. And people could really lean into it and gain that benefit. And then just lastly, on the magic wand question, when I asked Miles about the magic wand, he talked actually about his family and wanting to make sure his family had access and how there was that perception, that public perception, again, that barrier of not getting access. Whether it's talking to youth, seniors, especially coming out of COVID, have felt really isolated. And it's people don't talk about initially, but when you engage in the conversation, then it starts to come out. And people are feeling really lonely and really vulnerable in this area. And so I think more than ever, addressing mental health, taking the stigma out of it, providing support for it, seeing it as a part of our being healthy and having healthy communities is, I think, critically important at this time in terms of having enough staffing and enough support to do this work. I've proposed a civilian GI Bill that would be for professions, especially in the healthcare profession, education, many others, where someone could essentially go to college, go to their professional degree for free. They would sign a promissory note upfront. They would be able to get the education and then go and serve in an area where they're needed for their profession. Thanks for the great questions. So it's Jamie McLeod Skinner. I'm running for Oregon's 5th Congressional District. My website is jamie4oregon.com, and that's spell out F-O-R. It's not the number. And my email is jamie@jamie4oregon.com.
You're listening to Speaking Freely with Annette Newell. Thanks for tuning in here on your favorite Alpha Media radio station. If you have a topic you would like to hear about on this show, please send me an email about it to annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. One more time, that's annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. Join us again next week and check out our Speaking Freely podcast on KXL.com.